We're here today with Marama Davidson, and we've come off the air, we've gone down, and we've had a nice organic lunch, and we're back to expand on it, because Marama, you were late.
I was late. Sorry, I'm so sorry.
Not one of these Auckland traffic issues, was it?
More about getting the kids off issues and coming from South Auckland. And actually, me thinking, no, you don't want me for more than 20 minutes, surely. That was probably the bigger one.
The old self-degradation.
It's probably a relevant issue, because one person said to me recently, beware of overexposure. Mm. And actually that person might have been trying to pull me down in a way that he knew was going to play on me a little bit.
Mm.
So I started feeling a little bit self-conscious about how much airtime I'm getting and those sorts of things.
Well, my opinion is that if on airtime, if somebody offers it, you take it.
Yeah,
you
know? Totally.
It's kind of like one of my favorite radio show hosts in America, Jack Blood. I asked him, you know, what's two very standard pieces of advice for, you know, going on and getting all this coverage and still staying down to earth?
Yeah.
And he says, drink. Because, you know, if you don't have a few drinks every now and again, you'll go crazy. And take the money.
Take the money off.
If you're doing the same thing anyway, you know, like, and you're helping people, you're not hurting anybody, and people offer you money as a donation or something, don't just go, oh, well, I'm going to be all abashed about it. Just take the money.
Yeah, that's interesting, that point, because recently, you know, I don't have an income stream, and so I'm still trying to get out of the thinking where if I do something for a group of people or for someone and they want to offer some sort of a koha, I've got to get out of thinking I can't accept that.
Mm.
And I've just got to try and stop thinking of it as money and try and accept that they're trying to show their appreciation for something that I might have given. Mm. But when you're in a mindset of, no, this is my gift to the community or to the cause or whatever, it can block you from then thinking that you can accept anything in return.
Well, exactly. I mean, giving is just as important as accepting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And there's some cultures where if they offer you a something grand or whatever and you don't take it, they take offence to it.
Yeah, I often think, well, I could be being a little bit hypocritical there, because I remember saying very clearly once that it doesn't matter what someone does with your gift. It is what matters is the compassion with which you gave it. So I'm sort of like, I'm going against my own principle, you know. I did give something perhaps to a group, maybe I talked to them, maybe I did some workshopping, and whatever I accept back and receive from them doesn't eradicate my intentions of why I wanted to help that particular person or that group. So I've just got to start being a bit more real about that.
Because what I found is that just being independent, knowing what you're talking about and just doing what you do seems to be almost like you start to demonize yourself, like, I'm not doing enough, I'm not good enough, etc. When the reality is, actually, you're better than most other people because you're actually giving of yourself for the greater good. Why shouldn't you get something back for that? You know, you don't do it with the intention of getting something out of it. You do it with the intention of doing something that's right. And when you get something back, it seems like justice to me.
Yeah, I guess it is that reciprocity. And, you know, we've got to stop thinking of cash in the way of it, and we've just got to realise that sometimes people might want to pay you for what you do. Why does it make it any different that they might have baked a cake for you or something like that, where I would heartily accept the cake. But I should stop having an issue about accepting money and koha when that's what people want to give. So that's an important issue for all of us as activists, I think.
Oh, totally. And this is far removed from the I'm the mayor of Auckland, give me some recommendations business roundtable or slash council for Auckland who pay $10,000 a year to be part of it so that we can dictate crap across the city that prevents my favourite organic cafe from being able to have enough seats and tables in it.
Well, we just had the most beautiful lunch, and I'm going to be pumping out that organic cafe all over social media because it was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, it's Earthseed Organic Cafe, 1 Glenview Road in Glen. It's just the Shiite Muslim.
And it's really good.
Mm-hmm. And what we noticed there as well is that the other guy at a table was willing to have a conversation with us because the council had come in, reduced the amount of chairs and tables that they were able to have. It forced by proxy all the people that came there, still came there. nonetheless, not undeterred, to actually sit down and have a conversation with each other. And it occurred to me that we were all still talking long after we'd all finished our meals.
Yeah. It was neat that we got to sit at a table. We normally, in a standard cafe, you find a table for your own little group. It was neat that we got to sit at a table because of the way it's arranged, where there's a complete stranger there, but you just strike up a conversation. And we have been long removed from that sort of community feeling in the way that we live our public lives.
One of the elements that got brought up in the conversation was that of a vaccination. And you brought up the important issue, and I believe this actually bears looking upon, about the large quantity of vaccination programs that are directed specifically at South Auckland, lower decile areas and things of that nature. Because my opinion is the New World Order is a very racist, genocidal group of scumbaggery individuals. The system itself is predicated to hold a pin and down on Maori, Pacific Islanders and so on. Everybody in general, but them specifically. And they're using colour of law to say you can't even get into a daycare program or a school without vaccinating your child. There's no law that says that.
I think it's really important. Like, I strongly support parents' choices to make their own decisions about whether they vaccinate their child or not. But what I am concerned about is the way that the information is put out there to our communities.
What information is put out?
Well, actually, it's the information that says you must vaccinate your child or you will find it harder to enrol in this school or this ECE centre. So parents are being a little bit conned into thinking that unless they make the decision to vaccinate their child, their children aren't going to be able to enrol in public education, including ECE. Now, that's really concerning for me because I, as an educated parent, came up against the questionnaire to enrol my kids into primary school and suddenly felt a little bit stigmatised about the fact that I had stopped the vaccination program for my own children. Any parent with any less sort of information and knowledge about the law would think, oh crap, unless I make a certain decision, my children aren't going to be accepted into public education, and that is a big concern for me.
Well, why is it? What do you think is wrong about vaccines, and why don't you vaccinate your children?
I'm not too happy with the way that vaccination programs are funded by Ministry of Health in collaboration with big pharmaceutical companies. And I'm really of the mind that we need to be looking at holistic health as human beings, and that there are ways that we can avoid illness and sickness in the long term that are about eating good food and living a certain way of healthy life, where we don't have to put our children through a vaccination program. But again, I have seen people who stand against vaccination be really demonised, quite dangerously. A close friend, very demonised and marginalised. And so I'm often fearful about putting my own personal opinion out there. But I still think that there is a bias when it comes to information for parents to research and come to their own decisions.
Now, don't you think that if you choose not to do something and everybody demonises you because you're not going along with what everybody else tells you to do, that strikes to me as being a very, very sick and sad and unfree society, you know? It's just, people are so brainwashed into it.
Yeah.
They call it immunisation, as if you don't develop an immune system unless you have a succession of needles pricked in your arms.
Yeah.
Whereas Catherine Smith from the New Zealand of Journal of Natural Medicine here likes to call it vaccine because it comes from vacca, which is the original Latin for cow.
Mm.
And they talk about herd immunity, you know.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what vaccines, to my mind, truly represent, is a health herd mentality. Now, health is supposed to be an individual thing.
Mm.
I have the choice. Can a doctor force you to take something against your will, even no matter how good it might be for you? No, he can't. Yet, we have this social indoctrination program which makes people, through ostracization, demonization, various other forms of ation,
but
to try and get you to do it anyway, regardless of what you want, regardless of what facts in the issue that you've actually discovered, this is actually a really, really scary thing.
Yeah. Well, even without getting into the touchy issue of vaccines, we are generations removed from holistic health and well-being. Mm. And so it is going to take generations for all of us to claw back to eating food that isn't poisonous, to living ways of health that, you know, is about well-being for us. So we're so far removed from that, and companies, global conglomerates have an interest in keeping us in that mind frame because they make billions of dollars out of it. Mm. So, you know, I've said before that planting your own food, your own organic food, is going to become a rebellion act because there's no profit in that for some of these global conglomerates. And so that is why we are so far removed from thinking around holistic health anymore.
Mm. And also with food itself, putting some seeds in the ground is making money, all right? You know, because you're going to wind up buying that food otherwise, aren't you? Yep. Well, you're most likely is you wouldn't even be able to afford it, not with the food prices these days. And it won't be anywhere near as fresh. There won't be anywhere near as much nutrition in it if you buy it, even if you buy organic nowadays. Mm. Because let's say in the United States, the food labeling legislation allows for 10% non-organic contamination and have it still be able to be labeled organic.
Yep.
You know, you add on to that how the food bill legislation has allowed and has provisions for private armed mercenaries who are immune from any criminal prosecution, who can come onto people's land or home without a warrant and be able to boss you around and tell you what you can and can't do in your garden.
I certainly think that we all need to think seriously about what we've been sucked into in terms of marketing. So we eat some crappy food and, you know, McDonald's is in our face every day and all around our communities, our little communities every day. Our babies know the golden arches before they know the alphabet. Mm. So we do need to think about what is marketed to us and then understand that we have some sovereignty left to us as families in our communities to try and stay away from those industries that are making us sick, and then we go running to the doctor for band-aid sort of solutions that are not going to deal with the you know, that are only dealing with the symptoms and not the underlying causes of why we're sick. Mm. I don't even know need to go into conspiracy theories, but we just need to understand that our own capabilities for looking after our own bodies and our own minds has been robbed from us, and we've got to claw that back for ourselves.
Yeah, claw it back. Like a kitty.
Yeah.
And the other element that I say here is, and I've said this before many, many times, doctors aren't educated on nutrition. And as far as I've seen, if you've got proper nutrition, you barely ever develop any diseases because you've got immunity and the ability to fight off any kind of infections. And also your body doesn't wear out as much. You don't have heart problems or whatever. So what happens is you have the industries of food, whether they be genetically modified, whether they be rubbish food, like just loaded full of sugar, fat, salt, which addicts people. It's really addictive. So you get everybody eating all this addictive food that's really bad for them. And then once they start developing the symptoms of this bad food that they're eating, they go and they expect somebody who has no knowledge of nutrition, has never been trained in it, yet they have a white lab coat, therefore you can trust them to solve your nutritional problem without any nutrition.
There are more and more I'm seeing, I guess you could call them GPs or mainstream doctors, who are starting to click onto the fact that holistic understandings around nutrition and stressful lifestyles. So I have a doctor who, you know, manages to input those sorts of discussions into whenever I'm ill. But by and large, we're still fighting against that fallacy idea that we'll just keep shoving bad things into our minds and into our mouths, and then go to the doctor for a quick plaster, but we'll, you know, we won't change our symptomatic lifestyles around it. That is going to be one of the hard challenges, particularly for, you know, my people, my Māori people. We are addicted to those sugar and fat and salty things. I am myself, and if it wasn't for the fact that I have some sort of understanding that those things really aren't good for me, I'd be eating them all day. day, every day. But, you know, so I do have an understanding of how the addiction works. But because I'm also mindful of what else I need, I'm able to try and counteract it a little bit. But so many of my people, we're needing to help each other on a severe scale to get our thinking right to the level that it needs to be at.
Which can be really difficult when your communities are destroyed and disbanded by social policies of the government.
Or the corner dairy that is selling the 2-litre bottle of fizzy drink for $1 and the lunch pack with a packet of chips and some biscuits in it for $2, and that's, you know, easier and more accessible than providing a healthy lunch for our children. So we're up against structural marketing in certain communities and poorer communities as well.
And also on top of that, we've got food regulations, which I was speaking to Lisa Eyre, you know, the creator of Lisa's Hummus.
Yeah.
She was telling me that the enormous amount of red tape that you have to go through in order to produce a food product and get it out to market is obscene. And I was just thinking about this as you were saying it, you know, a little dairy, if they had a garden out the back or whatever, you know, they could easily be selling fruits, vegetables, homemade sandwiches, homemade bread and so on and so forth. But because they're actually making it and selling it, even if it's healthy, the fact that it hasn't gone through all the red tape and rigmarole and BS, it's illegal.
Which is why it is important for those who can, for those who have the means to support local growers, local organic shops and retailers, for those who have the means to be able to do that is really important. We cannot expect the struggling family who have a tiny income or who might be on a benefit, we cannot expect them not to take up the opportunity of the cheaper option. So those of us in the meantime who can buy the organic eggs and the free-range eggs must do that, and so that we can support those markets and those industries, and just continue with the education so that eventually we can bring up the rest of our families to be able to buy and participate in that better market as well.
I think farmers markets play a really important role with that idea. The problem with me, I'm a late night man, so getting up early and going into a farmers market and all of that kind of stuff is a real pain in the ass. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah. And, you know, there is a movement to really hamper and disadvantage our local growers and our organic growers, although we're seeing them slowly become more and more popular. So, again, more and more, as more and more of us can put our income and our finances into those markets, and we can, you know, in the meantime, others who can't afford that are going to keep buying the specials. But, you know, those of us who can afford and can put ourselves into those other organic and local markets really, really need to.
Now, have you said that there's a movement to disadvantage local farmers. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I just think with the legislation, let's just have a look at super malls, super shop malls. You know, my little Manurewa community, the local shops were shut down when Westfield Manukau expanded. The local businesses in South Mall died a quick death and have been replaced by finance loan shark shops.
I saw a lot of those when I was in Manukau.
Exactly. So now we don't have proper local shops. We have finance loan shark shops. We have terrible food, fast food shops. Those are the shops that our families in South Mall Manurewa now have to choose from, because the bigger malls came and absolutely wiped out the smaller local businesses in South Mall. So, you know, that's just an indication. You know, and some will say, well, those big malls, they provide some employment, they provide a market economy for our whole economy. I don't know, we've just undercut. We should be getting more and more local in our thinking, and those big malls, they don't do that for us at all.
Yeah, well, I can't name a single economy in the world's history going back 10,000, 20,000 years where it had a centrally planned economy and didn't wind up in either mass death or war. All right, and this is essentially what we're dealing with now, is the same failed policy of centralized economic governance and taking away power from the individual, winding up with a terrible situation that actually winds up costing lives. Of course, freedom included. Because,
yeah.
You know, you can't have a whole lot of freedom if you're already dead.
Well, another example, a local countdown opened in Manukau, and I don't know, there might have been, I don't know, maybe 150, 200 jobs that were up for grabs. And I think we saw a turnout of thousands.
It was like 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000?
Yeah. Thousands of people lining up to get any job they could in that supermarket. And, you know, this was straight off the back of Paula Bennett shaming South Aucklanders and saying that, you know, there are jobs out there, people are just too lazy to go and find them. She needed to come and stand in line with the thousands of people who were trying to get one job at local supermarkets. Yeah. That was a fail.
Paula's just shameful like that, eh? And, you know, I think that she's just a perfect little agent, don't you think? I was a solo mother, yeah. I was receiving a benefit, therefore I'm the perfect spokesperson to look after all the solo mothers who are on a benefit, and everybody trusts that, and then boom, they switch the tables on you and just do the direct opposite, counterintuition.
Her commentary is disgusting in the way that she feeds into making us stigmatise and have hate towards families who are struggling is really quite disgusting, and I don't know how she sleeps at night. But I really admire groups like Auckland Action Against Poverty, CPAG, groups who are fighting so hard against that sort of narrative, damaging narrative that she puts out there that does nothing to enhance and lift families into interdependence in their community.
Mm. Well, I want to make a point on this. How do they sleep at night? I was asking an expert on psychopaths one time, how would I know if I was a psychopath? And he goes, well, when you go to sleep at night, do your lights go out and you go to sleep instantly? Or you're always lying in bed for a little while thinking about stuff before eventually drift off? And I go, well, I'm always do a lot of my thinking before I go to sleep. And he says, well, you're not a psychopath.
Yeah.
Here's how the psychopaths sleep at night. They don't have a conscience.
Yeah.
As soon as the lights go out.
Gosh, I wish I have 1,000 things going around in my head every night. And I'll often wake up in the morning. I'll wake up in the morning and my first thought might be something as lighthearted as how do we stop the US war on Syria? You know, this is where the burden of a conscience lies.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's nice to have some chemical weapon.
Yeah. And that is a burden, and that is why when we get the opportunity to go and watch a play or a movie or just sit in the park and feed the ducks, we really need to.
Well, you do have to kind of have a good sense of humour about these things. And it was something I was talking about. This is the whole point of my show, is actually just to have a few laughs about these really serious issues.
Oh, God,
they're so painful to bear.
This is why often I just have to snap out of myself and stop taking myself so seriously, and that might result in me posting up something comedic on Facebook, which will often get 300 more likes than a serious political post, because we're all so hungry for time out in our brains and in our minds, and I think we really, to keep ourselves healthy and sane, we need to do that often.
Yeah, well, we don't have much of a choice, and this is what I notice is the difference between people like me and, say, interviewing people like John Key or whatever, is they're not really laughing about anything, are they? I mean, you notice the difference between somebody like us when we laugh, you see the eyes kind of narrow because we just can't help it, you know, and that kind of thing is a natural reaction. These people, their eyes are perfectly the exact same as normal, but their mouth is smiling. And you see that there's nothing actually going on up here that corresponds with what's going on down here.
That's really interesting.
It's just a little ploy. I think these people grow up knowing that they're different from everybody else, knowing that they don't have a conscience. And they figured out how to manipulate people over their lives, how to imitate certain emotions, imitate certain feelings, so that people won't realise that they're very different people indeed.
It certainly seems like, you know, their policies, their legislation and their commentary is certainly cruel. And shameful and disgusting. And I, like you, haven't spent a lot of time trying to analyse that because I find it so hard to even listen to them, to be honest. It's like, oh, I understand I need to have a political analysis of what they're doing, but I can't even bear looking at them. And so I haven't studied to the extent that you obviously have of where they're coming from, but all I know is that the dialogue that they're putting out, the policies and the legislation that they're progressing, sucks and is so wrong, and just drums up the sense of injustice inside me so strongly. And that's why we also need to take time out from that every now and then.
Yeah. I mean, well, if you want to understand their tactics, it's pretty simple. Power and control.
Yep.
That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
And the way that they get that done is through manipulation and deception. Power and control, manipulation, deception. That's all the politicians that we don't like in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah, which certainly appeals to our superficial sort of desire, our superficial desire for quick fixes to seemingly big problems. So something that seems like a quick fix to a big problem is what, for example, the National Party are feeding off. we were talking about weed spraying before, you know, and that's like one big sort of let's just spray the sheezes out of everything and that's going to sort it all. And that's the mentality that that is drummed into. Excuse me.
go for your life, love. Get it out of your girl.
Choking.
Yeah, because this is the other interesting thing when you talk about John Key and his other elements of scumbaggery. You just can't help it, you know, your body rejects it, you have to go to the bathroom and throw up and so on and so forth. But when I think about it, when I watch and listen, because I'm a little bit different to Marama, when I actually watch and listen to all of these kind of politicians and everything, it doesn't necessarily make me angry anymore. It actually sends me into hysterical laughter to a large degree, you know, because I know that what they're saying is complete and utter BS, so I'll listen to John Key and he'll say, "I'm here to help the economy." Oh, God. I just can't help myself, because what they're saying is so out of tune with reality that insane, comical laughter, I believe, is the appropriate response. And I think that this is what should happen during parliamentary sessions, is every time John Key or another member of the National Party or the Labours or whatever, every time they say something that is blatantly not true, everybody else in the whole House should just laugh their asses off at these people, these clowns who think that they can manipulate people endlessly and keep sucking down all the power and control and consolidating it into fewer hands. These people have no future. That includes us. It's all about them. All right? For a brighter future? Yeah, for me and my mates.
I think what is working and what can be one of the solutions is if you have the confidence to put your voice out there on these issues and stand up against the status quo, what I have found is that can resonate with other people from all different walks of life. And so part of it is being just one person who is trying to appeal to other people who may not yet have made up their minds or have been able to articulate for themselves what the problem is. They know inside them that something is wrong, but you might be that person to put it into words and allow them to say, yes, that is what is wrong. So if you can be that person, and if we can start to affect people in that way by being a credible voice on issues where people can flock to that voice and to that dialogue and say, yes, and I want to support that concept and that sort of thought, I think that is how we're going to try and win back the hearts and minds of the nation.
Well, you have to be bold when you speak, and you have to speak the truth without fear of the consequence, because the consequence of not speaking out will be far worse, I think, further down the track. And I think a little bit of pain now, you know, for the future, I think is well worth it.
I think it needs to be acknowledged that women in particular can find it challenging to speak out. And so the feedback that I keep getting from women from all different backgrounds is that it's a terribly scary thing to do, to try and put your voice out there, because you will just get knocked down. But when they can see someone else doing it, some other woman doing it, or someone who they can identify with, even just as maybe a parent, that will give them confidence, and their own sort of awakening and revolution can carry on. But the world is unkind to women, and has been for centuries, and it's patriarchal, and any world that is unkind to women is unkind to communities and unkind to families. And here I also acknowledge the many, many men who are supportive and are some of the best feminists I know, and also that women themselves can uphold the patriarchy. And this is when I talk about Paula Bennett and many others, and Judith Collins. So, you know, it's not so much a gender issue, it's more about striking down systems and institutions.
It's not so much about gender, it's about the agenda.
Yeah, exactly. So it is harder, it has been historically harder for women to get representation in the debate. So I think it's important that as many women as possible can do it.
Speaking of which, did you see the post about Penny Bright on News Talk's
Z? I haven't caught up with it.
She muscled her way into like oh, this is why I love Penny. Okay. All right, dig this. Picture this, ladies and gentlemen. There is a conference going on, okay? It's a mayoral debate, and only five male mayoral candidates, many of which have never run for mayor before, are invited, but Penny Bright, who's run for mayor before, is not invited. So she turns up anyway, goes and sits at the head table, and refuses to leave until they allow her to be part of the debate. And they let her. Because, and I was just thinking about this, it couldn't have turned out bad. Okay, here's why. A1, your possibility is you get allowed in the debate.
Mm-hmm.
So boom, you've gotten yourself in the debate. You actually get to talk to the issues. Option two is they have you physically removed, for which the headline will read,
yeah,
mayoral candidate arrested for trying to join mayoral debate.
Yeah.
And that would just be like, boom, you know you're living in a tyranny now, boy. So you can't lose. And that's the thing. You be bold, you get in there, you do something which other people do not have the gall to do, and you win by default, no matter what they do to you.
Yeah,
in fact, the worse that they do to you, the better.
Yeah, and being bold, there are many different ways of doing that. Some of my heroes, you know, are very softly spoken, don't get a lot of headline action and mainstream media and so forth. But they have been able to influence the hearts and minds of so many people because of the dignity that they possess, or because of the depth of thought and the way that they put it out there. So there are lots of definitions of being bold. And it comes down to personal style.
Yeah.
It definitely comes down to personal style. So I have a certain way of talking about things that may not be exactly the same as another Māori woman who feels similar about issues that I do, but that's her style, and my style is my style. And you can make mistakes too and be canned for what you're doing, but you just have to take that on board and keep going, really.
Yeah, well, you don't really have too much of a choice in the matter. It's like you are who you are, and you'll do things your own way. And this is what I think. Most people don't ever get to this point in their life where they realise, I am who I am and I must do things my own way, otherwise I don't feel right.
Yeah. And that's something that my father has taught me, both my parents actually, is speak who you are, and you can tell when you're doing something that doesn't feel right. There's something inside of you that is a check that will say, no, and you have to be very aware of your inner sort of conscience that says, what you're saying right now doesn't really align with who you are. Mm. And as a sort of political candidate, I had to be really wary of that even more so, about how much of what I'm putting out there is my own voice.
And how much is the party line?
And how much am I compromising? And thankfully, I was being supported to go out there as me. And so all of my sort of visions and values thankfully align so well with the party that I was promoting that I felt very supported to be who I am.
And see, that's a really good thing, but unfortunately, that's the reason why I can't really join organizations or things of that nature, because the things that I say are very, very controversial.
They sure are.
And they can get people in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
You know, really, I mean, if people took what I said and applied it to other people, you know, that guilt by association complex that people have got, which is completely made up and has no relevance whatsoever,
yeah,
yet it's stronger than ever nowadays, is it not? Had I come up and say I support the Labour Party or whatever, and then started talking about chemtrails or fluoride being a bad thing or whatever, suddenly the whole Labour Party's in the shtick and they kick me out. And I do believe that there is a strong element of that. Once you become far more successful, once there's a lot more riding on you, there becomes a heck of a lot more impediments to what you can say and do. And indeed, what happens is, this is a technique of mind control, and not a physical, you know, kind of, I'm going to give you acid and give you electroshock therapy kind of MK Ultra mind control, but they split your personality so that you have a public face and then you have your private face. And I believe within that element of switching your personality, catering it to different situations and essentially not being yourself in certain situations, that I think is one of the crux of the issues of why the political system is failing, because you can never tell who's standing for a political party is really being themselves or only being what they're being told to do.
There are some great role models, because I think you're right. Mostly it can be disheartening to listen to some of our political representatives, which is why, again, I feel really confident and privileged that the role models who I look up to in politics feel like they are real people. And also that isn't just a political, you know, a high-level political thing that can happen. People can lose their way even on the ground, in the community. You know, there can be people at my local marae, hapu whānau marae, who, you know, can lose their way and can lose their heart and their mind and what they're doing. So we shouldn't just confine those sort of losing yourself
it's a wide-ranging symptom.
It can happen anywhere.
But of course, one person at a hapu or a marae kind of losing their way, they can't pass legislation that can surveil and or exterminate the entire population.
That's true. Although they can have some, you know, depending on what position they're in, they can have some say at a local level. And we Māori have known for a long time that half the time we're fighting ourselves against decisions that I might not believe are kaupapa Māori decisions. So actually a lot of whānau and hapū are trying to fight some neoliberal economic decisions that are coming from our own people.
I was talking to some of the kingitanga when they invited me down to the Tikawiri Morai, and they were telling me, or at least I asked them, is there what's called a brown elite? You know how you got the Illuminati and the Rockefellers and Rothschild elite and so on and so forth. And down beneath them, there's all these other different families that are paid off that wind up implementing all of these other different policies that are against such and such groups or whatever. So my assumption was that whatever racial group is out there, whatever political organization, whatever non-governmental organization, whatever corporation, there'll always be some kind of element of scumbaggery within it that is attempting to corrupt the entire field. And the chief said to me, absolutely. That in the 50s the kingitanga bloodlines were married into by a number of other different groups who have since taken control of a lot of the tribal assets and interests and claims and so on and so forth. And I wanted to ask Willie and JT when they were interviewing John Ansell, he's, you know, questioning the treaty organisation, how much of the money from all of these hapus and so on and so forth is actually making it downstream to those who truly need it most. The I see families that cannot afford kids' shoes, who can't afford to buy their kids breakfast. You know, how much are these millions of dollars of settlements and things of that nature are lining the pockets of a certain section which are controlling the policy and the perception to the public of Māori versus those who actually need it?
Now, I don't have a lot of inside credible knowledge about what funds are going where, but certainly our own people are starting to ask those questions of our own people, and particularly through treaty settlements. I've seen some really good work come through some of the treaty settlements, and I've also seen the opposite, where whānau on the ground are sort of throwing their hands in the air and going, what on earth have we signed off on, and when and how are we going to see some of the benefits? You were talking about the Brown elite, and I think Annette Sykes' paper, The Politics of the Brown Table, which she delivered at one of the Bruce Jefferson lectures a few years ago now, is a really insightful critique, well-researched and well-written, as to what has been happening over the years with that sort of Brown Table, Round Table political elite, and the decisions that have been made, who has been blocked out of those decisions, who are those decisions benefiting, clearly outlines that we have had a Brown sort of table political elite for some time now.
And of course, for us to even talk about this, because I'm not Māori of descent, I can now be accused of being racist and so on and so forth for simply telling the truth and actually sticking up for Māori in general.
Yeah, it is. It is up to Māori to question these issues. Although, you know, some of us would say, look, why, you know, we need this out on the table, like any other corruption. It needs to be out there. We can't hide it in our own little Māori corners. So I sort of agree with that as well. But certainly Māori should be leading the dialogues that calls that will call our decision makers into account. Yep.
And of course, it's the same for people of my generation, you know, trying to get a voice amidst all the media scumbaggery and BS, is that the people who are currently in control hold all the purse strings, hold all the media eye, and so on and so forth. So to try and question them, you're basically pushing Shiite uphill.
Yeah, and we've seen countless examples. I supported the whānau Te Maru Haere Muri recently, who were against a hapū decision that sold off their river shingle. And so members of that hapū went and blockaded the Rau Kōkore River to stop the shingle trucks from taking that, because that will, of course, alter the entire ecosystem of their awa. And when you alter ecosystems, you muck around with so many biological and biodiversity processes. And these people knew that and they understood that. But here you had the case of a tiny handful of people, or maybe one person, who was able to make a decision that went against the will of a lot of the whānau on the ground. And so you had the whānau uprising and resisting against that decision that was made, that they didn't agree with. And that's one of many examples where decisions are being made by Māori on behalf of Māori that are quite opposite to the direction of a kaupapa Māori approach.
Well, exactly. I mean, and we're talking about tikanga law and that kind of thing, you know, perpetual balance. Think about the next generation. It's suddenly gone from completely unbalance it, steal from this generation so that we can benefit our very small comparative ruling class generation, which will be up next.
And also the amount of money that the river shingle was sold for was, you know, pocket money. And when we're talking about altering an entire ecosystem for good, we have to be really mindful of what we're selling that for. And we're altering the generational benefits forever. And so a few thousand dollars is not going to cut it when it comes to those big decisions that are being made. And this is why, and, you know, I'll put my cards on the table, and I am against risky deep sea oil drilling. I am against mining on some of, especially some of our conservation lands. And so for me, our kaitiaki responsibility as Māori is to think about solutions that are much more sustainable, and also call out the economic benefits of drilling and mining, because preserving our environment is where the economic benefits should lie.
And also the other element here is that things are not really equally applied, things are not equally distributed, voices are not equally heard.
Yeah.
We live in an incredibly unequal society nowadays, you know?
Yeah, so the government in these big decisions around oil drilling and mining, the government has their little collective elite group who they will consult with, and then they will say, we've consulted with Māori.
Yeah.
And actually they've written, a report was released recently where they had the cheek in to write and say, yep, we consulted with so-and-so hapū on this decision, and so-and-so hapū were going, what? When did that happen? You know, so the process is completely biased and flawed.
It's corrupt and intentionally so. Let's face it, Marama, there is no denying it anymore.
No.
The system, all the systems of control, all the ruling elites have become corrupted.
Yep, definitely. And I think that has been happening for a long time. The bigger challenge is, when will the masses really start resisting? We're still not resisting at the sort of level that we need to.
Mm.
It's still the same people turning up to protests on the street. It's still the same people making the submissions to Parliament. You know, more of us need to get on board.
Mm. Well, that's indeed what I've noticed over 6 years going to submission panels, protests, public meetings, is the huge quantity of familiar faces. And I do believe that you're correct, that there must be an element of increased involvement among the general population. If there is not, it's like the little brown hen or the little red hen or whatever that thing was, you know, trying to make some bread on her own, goes to everybody for help, nobody wants to help her, and then as soon as she's made that bread and everybody smells those sweet aromas of freedom or whatever, everybody comes in and says and wants something, I'm sorry, there's nothing for you because you didn't help out, you didn't contribute.
Mm.
And not to say that that's the case that we're talking about here. What we are talking about is those who are going out doing the work, and they're not being rewarded for it because nobody hears about it.
Yeah, maybe I'm being a little bit too cynical. Maybe recently, for example...
Is it possible to be too cynical in this day and age?
Oh, you can't be too cynical for your own health. Yeah. Maybe very recently, for example, with the GCSB bill opposition, we started to see more and more people who would never for a second call themselves activists or radicals suddenly get involved with the dialogue. So I think that's promising. I think we need to grow that. We need to grow the mass movement to stand up against the status quo and demand something better. Mm. I'll say, yeah, there might be some hope that we're starting to mobilise more of the masses, but there's still so much work to do.
See, I was thinking about a multi-strike platform, because what we've got here is essentially there's either individuals, it's kind of like scattering, right? You've got all of these scattered agendas coming at you. So you've got vaccines, food bill, asset sales, GCSB, foreign trade deals, all of this sort of stuff. So you've got the human race is like a fist, right? And it doesn't really have any sharp points. So if you come at a fist, you know, it doesn't matter where you hit. It's a smooth object. Yep. What I was thinking is that's what mass movements are. They're one fist trying to attack something that's coming at it from all different directions. Mm. And what I was thinking it would actually work is if you make it the tactic of the cactus. Cactus covers itself from every direction with spines, so that any time anything from any direction comes and tries to attack that cactus, they get a little prick to remind them. And this, I think, what individual resistance is really starting to really personify, is that for every conspiracy, for every bit of corruption, for every bit of scumbaggery that's being committed on anywhere on the planet, there's always, invariably, some activist there who's exposing it and doing it. And the masses don't hear about it because they're plugged into mass media. And this comes to my point that I don't believe the masses actually really truly matter in that sense of making real significant change.
Yep.
Throughout history, has always been small,
dedicated
groups of individuals who have made the change.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think by the masses, I'm more referring to what I call the I call it the bubbling revolution. Mm. It might not be big, you know, explosive revolution, but it is actually waking up one person at a time. Mm. And I call it the sort of bubbling revolution, which is happening gently. And I think it needs to. I think to be sustainable, we just can appeal to someone's revolutionary spirit, and that person might just wake up thinking about one more critical thought than they did the day before. Mm. And that is, we've got to take the pluses and the runs on the board for those sorts of awakenings.
Mm. And also, I've been noticing a real problem with them myself recently is that I've been detracting and arguing with and getting angry with other people who are resisting the same agendas that I'm resisting, mm. because they're not resisting it in the same way, or they're not covering certain things about it and what have you. And I'm just like, you know what, frack it. Differences aside,
yeah.
we all have the same yeah, goals, don't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, totally. Which is why I got a bit annoyed recently when I've been attacked by my own for the way that I'm speaking out about something. And all I can say is I will never, ever be able to appease every single person in the way that I'm doing something. But do it yourself then. Do it better yourself and understand that the way I'm doing it is not the only way, but it's what I can offer.
Yeah.
And my words and the absolute style that I may put myself out there might not be the way that you do it,
mm.
But I'm actually not going to oppose the way that you do it either, because we all count. Mm. We all count. I might have a totally different style to someone else, but it's actually still all part of the revolution.
Well, it's good when somebody decides that they're just not going to do nothing.
Yeah.
They'll do something, whatever it is,
yeah.
and do it in their own way.
Yeah.
And I believe that that's actually the way for movements to be successful,
yeah.
is if people do all of their resisting in their own way, don't need help, just go out and attack the enemy agenda.
Yeah.
Attack it by exposing it. Attack it by enlightening people to
yeah.
the dangers that they're currently in.
Yeah.
Because the only way for this agenda to go through, it's all-encompassing. It's basically just anti-freedom, anti-human at the end of the day.
Yep.
The only way to get rid of all of these aspects that we don't like is if people are aware of all of these aspects simultaneously. Only then, once there is a mass consciousness shift, I believe, will there be any possibility that people will, A, be able to understand the problem, and B, solve it.
Someone really wise, I must go and find the proper quote because I'm totally going to fail it right now, but someone really wise said that do what makes your sense to your heart with what you've got. And, you know, that is the only way that we can be successful in being part of the solution. So you use the resources that are available to you and make sure it's something that makes your heart sing, and do that. Mm. And so that sort of frees us of thinking, I have to do something big. I have to do something big, otherwise it's not going to count. Mm. It's actually do what sits inside you really nicely. Do it with what you've got, and do it with some confidence and some vengeance, and then you are part of the solution.
With some confidence and some vengeance. I like that. You know, it's a good combination
yeah.
of things. All right. Well, I think these are some good positive ideas that we managed to generate. And in terms of your personal wake-up, what actually inspired you to start coming out, really talking about the important issues? Did you have
yeah.
some kind of a trauma, or did you
yeah.
were you very successful in a particular area
no,
of life and
trauma.
Get fired away?
It was complete trauma, actually. Well, firstly, upon a bed of family background of activism, I should probably say. So my parents met as protesters, as young urban Māori teenage protesters on the steps of Parliament. So all my life I've witnessed them standing up for being Māori. But, you know, because I had children young and had a family young, I put away that sort of critical part of my thinking for many, many years. And then a man called David Rankin came and changed my life overnight when he threw me into mainstream media, when he tried to bully me because I was working for the Human Rights Commission. This is all out in public, so it's well documented. But basically picked up on a comment I said on Facebook where I called him Pukukohua, which is a Māori insult for boiling your head. And he took me to task for it. And I was bullied over several months of him trying to get me fired. He wasn't successful, but what he did do was throw me into a limelight that I was not expecting. And at the end of the day, all it did was make me even more determined to stand up for my beliefs and to stand up against people like him, who were just complete misogynistic bullies. So that was the start of me being stubborn and having a voice. And then I got into writing blogs and using Facebook and building up that platform and taking up the opportunities on media, radio, television, all sorts of interview opportunities, and not saying no. And, you know, that it just kept growing and growing, and to this day is still growing. So that's, you know, so it took an event, a traumatic event, for me to get a bit stubborn.
Yeah, well, I found that that's very true of everybody to a large degree. You know, there's two things that happens when you try to shut somebody up. Number one, they'll shut up. Yeah. Number two, you won't ever get them to shut up, and they'll only scream louder and louder until you can't ever possibly ignore them again.
Yeah, and what has been interesting is, you know, my profile has slowly been building and building, whereas David Rankin's credibility has just slipped down further and further down. So, you know, we feel sorry for him.
Yes, we do feel sorry for scumbaggery agents of the New World Order who are misogynistic and manipulative and lies.
That's right.
Yeah, you've got to feel sorry for those people. Now, okay, well, I think there's a good place and nice positive mentioning to leave there. Would you be so kind as to give us your website? You're on the Daily Blog, is it?
Daily Blog. I'm one of the bloggers on the Daily Blog. So you can certainly just Google Marama Davidson, the Daily Blog, and find me there. And that also links to my own, our own Māori Women's Group website, Te Whare Porohou, and my Facebook page as well.
All right. Marama Davidson, ladies and gentlemen, from thedailyblog.com. Or is it .co.nz?
I don't know.
Who gives a frack? If you search Marama Davidson, the Daily
what
Blog.
What do I know? I only write on it.
Yeah, she'll be right, bro. She'll be right. Okay, well, there we go. Ladies and gentlemen, Marama Davidson in all her glory and splendour. This is the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Thank you very much for your attention.